Good afternoon, everyone. So good afternoon, book and cat lovers, and welcome to the Sydney Mechanics School of Art, where curiosity never goes out of style. I'm Sophie. I look after the marketing events and the community here at the SMSA. Before we begin, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, who are the traditional custodians of this land. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and we honour the stories that have been shared here for millennia. A few housekeeping notes to keep things purring along. After the talk, Susanna will take your questions in a Q&A session. You'll also find her latest book along with some adorable tea towels and cards available for purchase in the foyer. If you haven't done so already, please set your phones to silent or switch them off. We want to keep the drama off the stage and not in your pocket either. And the loser just outside to the right. It's an absolute joy to have a full house today. A special thanks to our CEO, Lisa, for her incredible support of our team and our members, and to the wonderful members who are here today. It's always a joy to see your faces in the audience. And to our first-time visitors, and there are quite a few today as well, a very, very warm welcome. You've chosen the perfect day to join us. I'll stop, I promise. And if you have been thinking of joining our story-filled community, now is the perfect time because the 2026 memberships are officially open, and if you do sign up today or before the end of the year, your literary love affair can start straight away. And I promise that the 2026 program is shaping up to be really exciting. I've got some beautiful guest speakers lined up. I just can't share anything at the moment until the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, but keep an eye on the newsletter and on the website for the reveals. And for our first-time visitors, I'll take you on a super quick tour of our magnificent institution. We've been keeping Sydney curious since 1833. We're basically the city's oldest book club with benefits. Fun fact, we've birthed giants. We are the proud literary parents of the State Library of New South Wales and of TAFE. And we have Australia's longest running lending library with one of the largest crime fiction collections in Australia. We think this is being investigated. We're also a community of cat lovers, and it may not surprise you that our team's feline to human ratio is quite high. And while we may not have a resident library cat, I am working on it, as you may have seen if you look to the door. And there's a reason these creatures have always graced the halls of libraries and the studies of writers, because in their quiet companionship, they seem to understand the solitary work of reading and writing, that deep personal conversation between a reader and a page and a writer and their thoughts. And they are the gentle guardians of our quietest moments. Now, I could wax lyrical about the SMSA, but I want to shine a spotlight on the woman of the hour, the fabulous Susanna Fullerton. For the Austen fans among us, you'll know Susanna as the president of the Jane Austen Society of Australia, a role you've held for 30 years. And if that wasn't enough to keep a lady out of trouble, Susanna is also the patron of the Kipling Society, a founding member of both New South Wales Dickens Society and Australian Bronte Association, and serves as the lady patroness of the international, is it higher?
Higher. You can say either.
Society, so the grass certainly doesn't grow under your feet. And when Susanna's not presiding over literary societies, she's bringing history and literature to life through her brilliant books. And we're proud to have several in our collection, including Jane Austen and Crime, which is, I would say, the first serious exploration of duelling, poaching, and even murder in Austen's world. We also have Happily Ever After, which is celebrating Pride and Prejudice. And that's been flying off the shelves this year because we have been celebrating 250 years of Jane Austen. And now we have her latest delight, Great Writers and the Cats Who Owned Them. Because let's be honest, those of us who owned by cats can relate to this. But wait, there's more. Susanna has a recorded audio collection of poetry, and that brings poetry and Catherine Mansfield to life. She leads sold-out literary tours from Sicily to Scotland, and she shares her knowledge and passion with a monthly newsletter called Notes of a Book Addict. which has 5,000 people blissfully addicted to her literary recommendations. Susanna's also been a judge for major literary awards, is a regular voice on radio and television, and let's not forget she is a trained dramatic performer. So we're not just getting a lecture today, we're getting a show. In short, it seems that Susanna lives and breathes literature in all its glorious forms. She is the friend you wish you had to guide you through every bookstore, the teacher who makes classics come to life, and the storyteller who reminds us why we fall in love with reading in the first place. So let's raise the roof for the wonderful Susanna Fullerton.
There's no doubt that authors and cats go together wonderfully. Cats are very quiet in a study. They don't need to be taken for walks. They act as alarm clocks, waking a sleepy author who needs to get to work. They're comforting, they're beautiful, and they're inspiring. Authors love wordplay, and of course when you get a cat, you need to think of a name for that cat. And in the early part of my book, I give a list of some of the quirky, funny, and fabulous names that different writers have chosen for their cats. Cats can be used fabulously in fiction and short stories and things like that to reveal character. You know, if somebody treats a cat cruelly, they're not a character that's admirable within the book. In fact, cats have never really forgotten that they were worshipped as gods in ancient Egypt. They own us. They are never our slaves. So my book covers 17 different authors and the cats who owned and inspired them. I also include between the chapters little moments of pause for thought where I look at cats in bookshops, cats in libraries, cats in literary hotels, cats who have helped children learn to read, the very first book about cat care, the literary origins of the word tomcat, why do we call a male cat a tom? I cover the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland, Kipling's wonderful cat that walks by itself, and a whole range of other different little aspects of cats that are in some way or another connected with literature. The first of my authors in my book was Dr. Johnson, the great author of the dictionary, essayist, and so much more. Now, he was owned by Hodge. Life in 18th century London was not great for a cat. Cats were tolerated, but they were very rarely taken into the inner circle of a home and cherished as pets. They were often treated very cruelly. The very first Animal Protection Act in England was made in 1835. But in the age of the Enlightenment, gradually people started to feel that, yes, cats were sentient beings and maybe they did need to be treated a little bit more kindly. And cats began to appear more in both art and literature. Now, one cat was very lucky, and that was Hodge, who moved into this fabulous Georgian house in London, the Dr. Johnson Museum in London. And it's in Gough Square, tucked in just off Fleet Street. And this is where Dr. Johnson was working on the Dictionary of the English Language, which you can see there. Not the very first dictionary of English ever written, but certainly the first decent dictionary of English. And it was a huge mammoth task that took him years and years, and Hodge was there through the creation of the dictionary. I like to think that maybe one day he sat on the page defining C for cat and gave it his stamp of approval. Now, Dr. Johnson used to feed Hodge on oysters. This is a London oyster cellar. Oysters were then the food of the poor, unlike today where you pay a fortune for oysters in a restaurant. So Hodge seemed very fond indeed of oysters. One does have to wonder how fresh London oysters were that were carted around in a basket like this. Now, he didn't like to send his servant out. This is his servant Francis, rather wonderfully painted here. And he felt that Francis might feel it was sort of beneath his dignity to go shopping for animal food. So Johnson would himself go out to buy food for his cat. He couldn't really see where he was going. He had a dreadful sort of shambling walk, lurched along the street, but he would find an oyster cellar and he would get oysters for his cat. We know that Hodge died sometime in the 1770s, and Dr. Johnson did have other cats. This is a posthumous portrait of Hodge. It's not very accurate. Hodge was actually a sable cat, so very dark brown or even blackish. But as I say, this was done posthumously and the artist clearly had no idea. His future biographer and his friend, James Boswell, hated cats. He was almost a felinophobe. He really didn't like being in a room with cats. And one day he questioned Dr. Johnson about Hodge. Hodge was on Johnson's lap and was being stroked. And Boswell said, "Is this your favourite cat?" And Johnson said, "No, I've actually had other cats I've loved more." But then he worried that Hodge's feelings might be hurt. And he said, "But Hodge is a fine cat, a very fine cat indeed." Now, today, Hodge is wonderfully memorialised on this gorgeous statue, which stands just outside the Dr. Johnson Museum. It's sort of about that height, so children can come along and give Hodge a stroke, if they feel like it. He is sitting on a copy of the dictionary, and next to him are a couple of empty oyster shells. So he has been dining on oysters. And on the base of the statue are the words, "A very fine cat indeed." Hodge has been memorialised in many different ways, and there he is again with Hodge. An elegy of Hodge's death was written by Johnson's friend Percival Stockdale. Susan Coolidge, some of you might remember her book What Katie Did. She wrote a work called Hodge the Cat, and nearby Southwark Cathedral always calls its cathedral cat Hodge in Dr. Johnson's honour. And if you've read Agatha Raisin, you might remember that she has two cats called Hodge and Boswell. So I think Hodge was one of the luckiest cats of 18th century London to find Dr. Samuel Johnson. The next of my authors is a writer called Horace Walpole. Not much read today, but important in literature because he was the father or the inventor of the Gothic novel. He wrote a book called The Castle of Otranto, which gave everyone thrills and chills and got them all excited, and which sort of was a book that in many ways led to modern crime fiction. So he was important in the world of literature. He was the son of Britain's first Prime Minister, Robert Walpole. Now, poor Horace loved pets, but he wasn't very lucky with them. He really did need a pet cemetery. On one occasion, he had a little lap dog, and he was travelling with the dog to Italy. And they were crossing over the mountains into Italy in a carriage, a very high road up in the hills. And the little dog needed to get out to do its business. And while it was doing that, it was seized by a wolf and was never seen again. Now, Horace Walpole was very friendly, off and on, with Thomas Gray. He was the poet who wrote the wonderful Elegy in a Country Churchyard, "The curfew tolls the knell of passing day," etc. This friendship would prove to be important. Now, Horace Walpole got a cat called Selima, and she was a tabby cat. He got her about 1746. And together they lived in a very nice place in Arlington Street in London. And he would share his food with Selima and treat her with absolute devotion. Now, he loved collecting nice things around him. And he ended up buying a very beautiful Chinese bowl. Lovely blue and white china was just starting to come in from the East. So this would have been expensive. Yeah, it's quite large. He was very proud of it. And he filled it with water and he put goldfish in it. Now, we take goldfish for granted today, but then they were a really exotic rarity. A goldfish was something to show off to your visitors. So he loved the goldfish and he loved the bowl. In February 1747, Selima, who also loved the fish, was watching them in the bowl. You can guess what happened. She climbed onto the edge. It was had no proper grip on it. It was slippery, and poor Selima fell in. No servant heard her frantic cries, and she ended up drowning in the bowl of goldfishes. And there she is in an illustration by William Blake. Now, that wonderful bowl is today on display in Horace Walpole's magnificent home, Strawberry Hill, which is in Twickenham in London. The cat statues are not normally there. They were a temporary exhibition. Now, of course, Horace Walpole was a writer, But he was not a poet, and he wanted Salima's tragic death to be memorialised in poetry. So he called on his good friend, Thomas Gray. They were speaking to each other at the time. And Thomas Gray wrote a poem called Ode on the Death of a Favourite Cat Drowned in a Tub of Goldfishes. So there's no suspense in the poem. You know from the title what's going to happen. It was hugely popular, and it has been anthologised hundreds of times since, and it's circulated amongst Walpole's friends, and everybody loved it. He turned it into a sort of morality tale about greed. The cat's there watching the gold flickering and longs to have the gold. So he sort of gives a moral to his poem. So it was published and with many different illustrations over the years. So William Blake was one of those who illustrated it, and with rather unusual illustrations. And it was also illustrated by an American writer called Kathleen Hale. She wrote a children's book that some of you might remember called Orlando the Marmalade Cat. So that picture on the front of this book, which is all about the cat, is one of Kathleen Hale's. So I think these poems and these works of art have given Salima a posthumous fame to which she would have purred applause. I loved writing about Robert Southey. He was poet laureate, biographer, historian, poet, essayist, and travel writer. Now, he's not much read today. As I said, did become poet laureate, but he's sort of gone out of fashion. He was very friendly with the romantic poets, so he knew Wordsworth. He and Coleridge married two sisters, so became brothers-in-law. But I can guarantee that everyone in this room has read something by Robert Southey. He wrote a story about three bears and a little girl who comes to visit and tries the plates of porridge. So the little girl was not originally called Goldilocks. That came a little bit later, but you've all read Robert Southey's The Story of the Three Bears. Now, Southey lived at Greta Hall in the Lake District, and he filled the place with cats. He later wrote a memoir about the cats of Greta Hall. But his absolute favourite cat was Rumpelstiltskin. He'd been reading his children the Grimm's fairy stories when Rumpel arrived, so hence the name. And he said Rumpel was a tabby with a splendid tail, which in cats is undoubtedly the seat of honour. His eight children all loved cats as well. He created a cat's Eden at Greta Hall and said a house could never be perfectly furnished for enjoyment unless there is in it a child rising 3 years old and a kitten rising 6 weeks. So you need a small child and you need a kitten. Now, he grieved when his cats died, and there were no vets in the Lake District at that time. The very first college for training vets was in France in 1761. But it took a long time before they got trained in Britain, and then they were mainly in the big cities, and then they mainly treated the valuable animals, like the horses, used for work, of course, and transport, or dogs used for hunting. So cats were quite a long way down the list of priorities when it came to medical treatment. So if your cat got sick, you could consider drowning it to put it out of its misery, or you could just let it go away somewhere and quietly die. So I try and include in my book lots of historical information about the treatment of pets over the ages. So Rumpel came in the 1820s, handed over as a kitten. He was an excellent ratter, and Southey worshipped him. But then another cat arrived, and he was named Hurley Burleybus. Major feuds, meowing and yowling in the middle of the night with cats territorially fighting each other. But finally, a truce was reached, and Hurley stayed outside, and Rumpel was left to enjoy Southey's library, which you can see there. I also look at what you fed cats on. You know, there was no such thing as whiskers in those days, so what were cats fed on? And how did you deal with their toileting needs before cat litter was invented? So I try and include some of that sort of information. While travelling, Southey asked about his cats. He told his children cat stories. And when in 1833 Rumpel died, he was absolutely devastated. There should be court mourning in Catland, he said. But he comforted himself with the fact that Rumpel had had as long and happy a life as cat could wish for. And there's the outside of Greta Hall. And so Rumpel inspired letters and poems and was an enormous comfort to Robert Southey. And Greta Hall, there it is today, it has been home to Coleridge, home to Southey. It then became a girls' boarding school, and it is today a B&B, so you can go and stay there if you're in the Lake District. And cats still roam the property today, so Southey would have approved. Then I have a French writer, the great Alexandre Dumas, who was owned by Maisouf. Maisouf won because he was followed by another Maisouf, too, and his son had a third Maisouf who became Maisouf III. Dumas, as a young man, went off to Paris to make his fortune. He found work. He had very, very beautiful handwriting, and he got a job with a duke copying his letters and important documents because his handwriting was so gorgeous. He found himself a mistress, in fact, many, many mistresses over his time in Paris. He began writing plays, and eventually he turned to historical novels and became one of the most famous writers around Europe. So everything that Dumas said and did, his mistresses, what he wore, his cane, his snuff boxes, whatever it was big news. Now, by the 1820s, he was living with his mother in Paris and was joined by a cat who he named Maisouf. He did have a rather unusual taste in pets. This is his pet vulture called Diogenes Jugurtha. Isn't that the most wonderful name for a vulture? Evidently, he nipped the ankles of everyone who came near him, so not a very nice pet to have. But he had pet monkeys, and he had a great range of different animals, and he wrote a story of his pets. Now, he was working for the Duc d'Orléans, and every day he had to walk to the office. So Maisouf would escort him along the road to the corner, and every evening would meet him at the same place. Even if Dumas left the office late, Maisouf somehow seemed to know and would only set off just at the time that Dumas was actually walking to the corner. And he would then escort Dumas home like a dog. Maisouf, too, who is black and white, ended up killing some of Dumas' pet birds and was put on trial for the crime. But Dumas loved the cleanliness of cats, their lithe beauty and suppleness, and he felt they had a wonderful sense of self-worth. I hope our feline friend round the corner is listening to all of this. Dumas, and you can see him here later in his life, actually formed a feline defence league in France. Guy de Maupassant, who wrote an essay on cats, was a founding member, as was Anatole France. So this was formed in 1845, making it one of the oldest animal protection groups in the world, and it was founded by Alexandre Dumas. He loved the beauty of cats and celebrates them in many different ways in his writings. A particular favourite of mine was Foss, who owned Edward Lear. Edward Lear was Foss's very devoted slave. Now, for a long time, Lear didn't have a lifestyle that was really suited to having a cat. He was a wonderful artist, and he'd travel around Europe painting landscapes and different scenes, and also birds. He loved painting birds. And so travel was a part of his livelihood. He also suffered from epilepsy, at that time little understood and often something of great embarrassment to the poor person suffering from it. So he would sort of shut himself away and in many ways I think led quite a lonely life. But in 1871 he took a house in San Remo in Italy. He still had to travel occasionally for his painting, but a neighbour had a governess who had actually known Charlotte Bronte. And this governess gave Lear a cat. His first cat was called Potiphar and was considered by Lear to be a model cat. Lear adored him. But Lear had to go on a painting trip. The servant took Potiphar to his home in Corfu and Potiphar disappeared. But Rosa the governess came to the rescue again and she gave him Potiphar's brother, a Adurphus, but it was always shortened to Foss. Foss would not have won a feline beauty competition. He was rather portly, and he only had half a tail. You can find out why in my book. And he was tiger-striped. But Lear adored him, and Foss very rapidly came to rule the roost, and visitors were judged on their responses to Foss. In fact, he loved Foss so much that when he had to move out of his house and he ended up building a house just further along the coast. He built the house to exactly the same design as the old one so that Foss would know his way round and wouldn't be put out by the change. He very frequently drew Foss. He did a series of alphabet letters, so this is, of course, C for cat. He wrote of Foss in his letters. He had already written The Owl and the Pussycat, one of those great works of poetry, but he put Foss, of course, into many of his limericks. So he and Foss grew old together. And Foss died in July 1887. Lear was devastated. He gave him a very elaborate funeral and designed his headstone. Lear died only 2 months later, and his own funeral was a much simpler affair than that of his cat. Now, Foss, I'm delighted to tell you, has his own Wikipedia entry and has been the subject of a pop song. Lear wanted a photograph of Foss, so he was sitting posing with Foss in the crook of his arm. But it took a while taking photos in those days, and just before the photographer clicked the camera, Foss leapt off and disappeared. So this is the photograph of the cat that should be there and isn't. So I think it's fabulous that Foss has achieved all of this fame. This stumpy-tailed, portly, and unattractive tabby cat has achieved his own immortality. And there's another picture. Foss looks fed up with being drawn by Lear, but rather fabulous pictures with so much character. Charles Dickens was much more of a dog man than a cat man, in both life and in his fiction. There are over 500 references to dogs in his novels, far, far fewer to cats. Crook, a nasty character in Bleak House, has a cat called Lady Jane, who is very menacing. Aunt Betsy Trotwood of David Copperfield has a cat, and there are just a few others, but not many. Dickens' daughter Mamie was given a kitten on a visit to London, and very reluctantly Dickens allowed the cat inside the house. He was named William, but then he gave birth to a litter of kittens, so he had to be renamed Williamina. Williamina carried all her kittens into Dickens' study. He picked them up and he took them all out. Williamina brought them all back again. He took them out again, but eventually he gave up, and many of the kittens were given away, but one was kept, and he was named Bob, and very soon he was known as the master's cat. Dickens came to love him. Now, Bob was a white cat, and he was deaf, and so he probably couldn't hear himself meow. So in order to attract Dickens's attention, he had to come up with different ways of doing it. And he would literally snuff the candle with his paw. And Dickens would then have to look up from his reading or his writing and give Bob the attention he needed. Did Dickens ever say this? What greater gift than the love of a cat? It's plastered on carry bags and mugs and post-it notes on the internet, but almost certainly he never actually said it. So you do have to watch what's out there on the internet. It's not always accurate. But do we want favourite authors like Dickens to be cat lovers? Because we are. Do we credit these sayings to somebody even if they never actually said them? Now, that paw that snuffed out the candles has had a very interesting posthumous fate. Bob died in 1862, and Dickens's sister-in-law arranged for Bob's paw to be made into a letter opener. And there it is. So, not something most of us would want to open our letters with, but Dickens evidently very happily opened many letters with Bob's paw, and this is now in a library in the United States on display. The Victorians loved recycling and taxidermy, so why waste a good cat's paw if you had one going spare and could use it in something else? I loved writing about Mark Twain. You quote Mark Twain and everybody laughs. He worshipped cats, so much that when he was staying in hotels on his many travels, he would arrange to rent kittens, so he always had a kitten to play with in the hotel room. He judged other people on their responses to cats. If you didn't like cats, he really didn't want to know you. You were simply not, you didn't count in his view. He loved also giving them very provocative names that he thought might upset the neighbours when he went calling for Satan in the garden at night. Now, he was owned by Bambino, probably not this kitten, But his daughter Clara was suffering from mental health problems, and she was spending some time in a nursing home. And she smuggled in a little black kitten called Bambino. She was told it had to go from the nursing home, so she handed it over to her father. But then a catastrophe occurred. Bambino went missing in New York. Twain offered a $5 reward and advertised in the newspapers for the return of his cat. Hundreds and hundreds of people clutching black cats turned up, not because they were convinced they had Bambino, but because they wanted a glimpse of famous Mark Twain. And you can find out what happened to Bambino when you read the book. So he always gave Bambino precedence through the door. He loved what he called his straightforward selfishness and beauty. That's Bambino on the chair there. He spoke to them in different languages. He was convinced his cats yowled in German, so he had a lot of fun teaching them different languages, or thinking he was. He sought them out on his travels. He wrote about them in many stories. Cats come into a lot of his works, including this short story. And he helped establish a new American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. He even adapted his favourite game of billiards to suit cats. So if one was asleep on the billiard table, you were penalised if you woke the cat up. Or if one was nestling in the little pocket, as you can see there with that lovely kitten, then, of course, you couldn't hit a ball into the pocket because it would upset the cat. So all the rules got readapted for the game of billiards if a cat was on the table. And Mark Twain once famously said, "If man could be crossed with the cat, it would improve man, but it would deteriorate the cat," which I think is a really wonderful saying. That's on my cat tea towel, which is out there on the table. Another French writer is the great Colette, owned by the very unimaginatively named La Chatte, which simply means the cat in French. In 1926, Colette went to a cat show in Paris. The very first cat show ever held had been in London 2 years before, and this started something of a feline frenzy round Europe, with people getting interested in the different breeds of cats and what were the personalities of the breeds, all that sort of thing. So Colette went to the cat show, and she saw a cat called a Chartreux cat, or Chartreuse if it's a female, and she fell totally in love. And there she is with two of her Chartreux cats. They're large, muscular cats, very intelligent, observant, and polite. Evidently, Charles de Gaulle had Chartreux cats as well. She named it La Chatte, that first one. "Time spent with cats is never wasted," she said. She'd always loved cats. She'd put them into her Claudine novels, written when she was still quite young, and, of course, many other works, including this novella about a newly married man called Alain and his bride and his cat. The bride starts to feel that Alain is paying far more attention to the cat than he is to her, and we then get rather dramatic results, which I tell you about in the book. Colette had three husbands, but I think preferred her cats to all the husbands. One said to her, "When I enter the room where you're alone with your animals, I feel I'm being indiscreet." She moved to the Palais Royal in Paris, and there had many more Chartreux cats. She wrote Dialogue de Bête, which is a dialogue between her dog and her cat. But La Chatte had to be put down in 1939, and she was devastated. "Perfect friends are invariably four-footed," she said. Colette has been described as, quote, "the frizzle-headed catwoman of 20th century French literature." Perhaps not a bad way to be remembered. As an Anne of Green Gables tragic, writing, of course, about Ellen Montgomery was huge fun for me. And Daffy was the cat who watched the birth of Anne of Green Gables as a novel. In 1892, Montgomery wrote down an idea for a book in her journal. "Elderly couple apply to orphan asylum for a boy. By mistake, a girl is sent them." It was only in 1905 that she returned to the idea, and she wrote Anne of Green Gables, getting up early in the morning, putting on extra coats to keep warm in the winter, with Daffy snuggled on her lap like a hot water bottle. So Daffy was there in the creation of that wonderful novel. Now, Montgomery's life, and there's Daffy, was not always easy. She lost her mother when very young. Her father remarried and moved away. He left her with her grandparents, who were very strict Presbyterians and sort of did their duty by her, but they didn't like cats and didn't want cats in the house. She would smuggle the cats in. She adored them when she found them outside in the barn, because everyone kept cats to keep the rodents away. She kept little tufts of cat hair in her scrapbooks. When her cats died, she wrote long obituaries about them. One goes for 30 pages about one of her cats. And loving cats in her fiction is a real test of character. When Gilbert Blythe proposes for the second time and offers as part of the proposal a cat, you know that Anne Shirley is going to accept him. But cats helped her to cope with a very difficult marriage. She married a man who suffered from serious depression. She lost a baby. She had a very difficult son. She had legal battles over copyright. She suffered from terrible depression. She said it rested her just to look at her cats. She even chose a new house in Toronto because she thought the rooms would suit her cats. And she used to add a little cat silhouette to her signature when she replied to her fan mail. Later on, she had Lucky. And Lucky was the cat to whom she actually dedicated a novel and was probably her absolute favourite. But I think the cats were misnamed. I think Daffy was the lucky one because it was Daffy who was present in the creation of one of the world's great novels, Anne of Green Gables. Winston Churchill and Nelson were the next pair that I discuss in my book. Nelson became Chief Mouser at number 10. It is a proper title, Chief Mouser, and greatly assisted the war effort. Now, Churchill, of course, we remember today mainly as a great Prime Minister, but he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, so he was a very fine writer indeed. And he loved all animals, dogs, horses, ducks, cats. Pigs were a particular favourite. He was really partial to pigs. So this is a cartoon of Nelson keeping the Prime Ministerial stomach warm. In 1940, Churchill was outside the Admiralty building when he saw this very big tomcat chasing an extremely large dog down the street. He was so impressed with the cat's bravery, found that the cat had been hanging around and was homeless, took him home and named him Nelson after the great hero of the Admiralty, Lord Nelson. Soon they moved to Downing Street, so Nelson went too and was very pampered. He would pour cream onto the table and Nelson would lick it up. Nice pieces of salmon were served to Nelson. He called him darling, so Clemmy never knew whether he was talking to her or the cat. And he said that Nelson greatly contributed to the war effort because he was the Prime Ministerial hot water bottle and he also de-stressed the Prime Minister. He did have other cats. There's Tango, a marmalade cat, and this rather nice painting of the Churchills. But I was fascinated to learn that at the start of the war, many people were actually encouraged to have their pets put down. There was a real worry that if buildings were bombed, animals would be left, you know, confused and traumatized, no home, people couldn't find them. And also with rationing coming in, what were you going to feed your pets when they didn't know if you'd have enough to feed people? So it's thought maybe as many as 750,000 cats were euthanized at the start of World War II. But then they realised perhaps that wasn't such a good idea. Cats were actually needed at grain stores to keep those mice away. And also they provided therapy for men on ships and in the army. Churchill loved all sorts of cats. He was given a lion cub, which he was very keen to keep at number 10. He thought it might do wonderful things to the opposition. But in the end, the lion cub started to get a little bit too big and was handed over to the zoo. And Churchill used to go and visit his lion quite frequently. We don't know when Nelson died. However, after Churchill's death, he had another cat he loved called Jock. And the descendants insisted that at Chartwell there would always be a cat in residence and the cat would always be called Jock. So there is the current Jock making himself very comfortable on Churchill's shoulder. So there are still Chief Mousers at number 10 today. I think Paw Patrol is alive and well in Downing Street to this day. Ernest Hemingway was such a macho man, hunting, shooting, fishing. But when it came to pussycats, he was a total softy. On Christmas morning, 1942, he took his sons to this restaurant in Cohima in Cuba. A scrawny cat arrived and they fed it on prawns, and the boys begged for the cat to be adopted. Hemingway could never resist a cat, and he took it home, and he named the cat Boys, and there he is. Boys became his favourite of the many cats who owned him in his life. He immortalised Boys in 35 pages of his novel Islands in the Stream, giving the cat in the book the same name, the same tricks, the same habits. Hemingway used to teach Boys different tricks, shared his bed, of course, with his cat. Fortunately, all four of his wives loved cats, and he wrote about Boys in his letters. One cat just leads to another, he said. By 1945, he had 23 cats on his property in Cuba, and by 1954, there were 54 of them. So he had to build a special tower in the grounds for the cats. But Boys was able, his number one favourite, was able to remain in the house. And he used to very frequently call his wives Cat or Kitten. And if he chooses a name like Catherine, starting with Cat, and he does that in a couple of his novels, you know he's paying the woman a compliment. Now, he moved to Florida, and there he was given a very unusual cat called Snowball. Snowball was a polydactyl. Oh, there he is enjoying his cat. Snowball was a polydactyl cat, which means he's got an extra toe, a six-toed cat. And Snowball had descendants, and polydactyl cats still roam at the Florida Museum of Hemingway's home today. He loved the emotional honesty of cats. He called them his love sponges. Boys died in 1956, and Hemingway was certain that one day he and Boys would be reunited in heaven. Margaret Mitchell was owned by a very disreputable cat called Old Timer. Now, she was not an easy child. She was a real tomboy from the very beginning. And one day her parents got her all nicely dressed and took her to a photographer to have her photo taken. And Peggy, as she was called, was having none of it. She totally threw a whammy and misbehaved. But the photographer said, "Look, Peggy, I really need a photograph of this kitten. Would you mind holding the kitten so I can get a photo of him?" So then, of course, she behaved beautifully and held the kitten, thinking the photo was just of the kitten. But she loved cats throughout her childhood, taught them tricks, played with them. She wrote her one famous book, Gone with the Wind, in 1937. In 1937, it won the Pulitzer. And that was the year she got Old Timer, a stray and very disreputable. This is not Old Timer. We have no photo of Old Timer, but a rather beautiful photograph of her with a cat. She was living in this house in Atlanta. Now, Old Timer loved fighting all the cats in the street. And he came in rather the worse for wear one day from one encounter. And Margaret Mitchell commented in a letter to a friend that Old Timer's equipment had been rather badly damaged. Now, she had to put ointment on said equipment, and he licked it off, and she wanted to put him in a diaper. But her husband, John, said, no, that's too much for any cat's dignity to be in a diaper. You can't do it. Anyway, gradually the equipment got really very badly infected and had to be removed. Or as Margaret Mitchell said, his equipment has gone with the wind. So Old Timer was there in the build-up to the famous movie, but he vanished in 1947, was succeeded by Count Dracula, who was so badly behaved he had to be given away. But I think her real cat portrait in her writing is Scarlett O'Hara, who was given many feline qualities. And I give information in my book about cats during the Civil War. Robert E. Lee in the South, Lincoln in the North, both loved cats. So it might have been the only thing they ever had in common. But Vivian Lee, who immortalised Scarlett O'Hara, of course, was crazy about Siamese cats. So they too had cats in common. And the last photograph taken of Margaret Mitchell showed her with a cat. Dorothy L. Sayers is a wonderful mystery writer. I'm sure they've got her novels here in the library in the really excellent crime fiction section. The very last sight she ever saw in this world was her cats waiting to be fed. She'd come in from a day in London, the cats were waiting inside the door, she wasn't feeling very well, and suddenly she collapsed at the bottom of the stairs. But she'd always loved cats, and in London got Adelbert, who was a very good mouser. And for the rest of her life, there were cats. She wrote about them in her Christmas cards and letters. She even wrote poems about her cats. She took a house in Witham in Essex, and it wasn't easy living there with cats during the war because of the rationing. She wrote a wonderful poem called War Cat, where she addresses her little cat, Blitz, and says, "I'm so sorry, but I just can't give you the sort of food you really want." It's a lovely poem. So she had found Blitz as a ginger kitten in a bomb site in London, and she took him home and named him rather fabulously Blitz. So she mentions him very frequently in her letters. And he is today immortalised in a statue just outside the Witham Library. There's Dorothy with Blitz at her feet. And it was a bit dangerous going to visit her during the war years because the cats had a lot of kittens and you were very likely to leave her house with a kitten tucked under your arm, whether you wanted one or not. And again, I think she gives her character, Lord Peter Wimsey, many feline qualities, and a cat is actually a part of his family crest. Blitz lived to be 15, the wisest and best of the lot, she said. Paul Gallico, another American writer, longed for a cat as a boy, and he would later put this into his excellent novel, Jenny, about a little boy who longs for a cat and is not allowed to have one. He had an interesting career, first of all as a celebrity sports journalist. Then he wrote novels. He was actually the author of The Towering Inferno, which became one of the very first sort of disaster movies. He wrote Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris and its sequels. And he wrote The Snow Goose, a lovely World War II novel. And finally, living in England, he felt he had a home that he could share with cats. So soon he had 23 of them, strays, gifts. He could never turn away a cat, and one of them was a smoky grey cat who he named Sambo. Sambo went missing for a while, and then Paul Gallico found that the cat was two-timing him, enjoying a lovely meal at the house down the road, and then arriving starving at Gallico's house and having another meal there. And he wrote many books on cats, The Gorgeous Jenny, Thomasina, the cat who thought she was God, and The Silent Meow, which is as if written by a cat, and it's a manual on how to train your human. So how to get your human to be the very best sort of cat slave if possible, and a book called Honourable Cat. So he was a cataholic. And he reflects on the cat's purr. We don't really know why a cat purrs. It's not to scare off other creatures. You know, there doesn't seem to be a biological reason for a purr, but what a wonderful sound a deep, throaty purr is. Dame Muriel Spark, Scottish writer, was owned by Bluebell, and she was very like a cat herself. Bluebell was a blue-grey, half-Persian cat who was absolutely adored. And she wrote a poem about Bluebell. She included the cat's tricks and namesake in her novel Robinson, and she said every writer should have a cat to critique their manuscripts. "I cannot speak highly enough of the cat, its casual freedom of spirit, its aloof anarchism, and its marvellous beauty." She wrote an essay on Ilurophilia. If you're an Ilurophile, you are a cat worshipper. And her memoir makes frequent references to Bluebell. But Bluebell died only at the age of 4. The vet had to put her down. And Muriel, as an author, wrote of the whole procedure. And she vowed no more cats. But that's, of course, something that nobody ever listens to. Inevitably, you get another one. And she ended up getting Spider from fellow novelist Patricia Highsmith. And the two authors would correspond about Spider's welfare. And she settled in Tuscany with 7 cats. Muriel converted to Catholicism and was quite certain that when she went to the pearly gates, Bluebell would be there waiting for her. Doris Lessing was owned by El Magnifico. She grew up in Rhodesia, place of big cats, but not a safe place for little ones. But she fell madly in love with cats, and she was always happier with cats than with other human beings. She wrote about cats that she had during her life, including one called Rufus. She wrote Rufus the Survivor. But it was her last cat who was her absolute favourite, and you can see him there, a beautiful, big, black and white cat who was named El Magnifico. She worshipped him. Delicious cat, exquisite cat, satiny cat, cat like a soft owl, cat with paws like moths, jeweled cat, miraculous cat, 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 cat. And you get the picture. He ruled her home. But at the age of 14, El Magnifico got a lump on his shoulder. He had bone cancer, and one of his legs, a front leg, had to be amputated. Doris Lessing writes so movingly of her disabled cat in a lovely little booklet, really. It's like a short story called The Old Age of El Magnifico. It's a marvellous piece of writing about his disability and how he had to learn to live without one of the legs he had been used to. She wrote particularly cats. She wrote a short story, An Old Woman and Her Cat, and in 2007 she won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So she wasn't great dealing with human beings, but she was absolutely fine with cats. Now, I wanted to end my book, if possible, with a living author, so I thought carefully about which authors are out there today who are owned by their cats. And in the end, I was very fortunate to get wonderful help and encouragement from the fabulous New Zealand writer Dame Lindley Dodd, who created Harry McCleary from Donaldson's Dairy, and of course created Scarface Claw and Slinky Malinky. So she grew up with cats, and she had Squib, here he is in his bed, an absolute terror on the streets, but a complete softie at home. So he becomes the model for Scarface Claw in the wonderful stories. She married Tony, who also loved cats. There she is again with a cat. And together they got a cat called Woosket from the RSPCA. Black, noisy, full of character, with a kink at the end of his very long tail and bright yellow eyes. He, of course, is the model for Slinky Malinky. Now, in 1972, she teamed up with Tony's cousin, and they wrote My Cat Likes to Hide in Boxes. This was very successful, and then she went on to write the Harry McCleary books, and, of course, the Slinky ones as well. Millions of copies have sold. They've been made into TV adaptations, and I think children who don't know Harry McCleary have really missed out. I frequently buy them as baby gifts. I think, you know, everyone needs Harry McCleary. Woosket died in 1981, but Slinky Malinky is, of course, immortal. She had other cats, including Suki, a Burmese, named for Aung San Suu Kyi, the Burmese activist. But at the moment, she said she is catless, but she thinks maybe it's time for another meow at her door. She loved drawing her cats, and the cats have fantastically, I think, I've yet to go and see it, been turned into statues on the waterfront in Tauranga in New Zealand. So there's some Scarface Claw up on the top of the pole taunting the dogs, and there's Slinky Malinky slinking along in the gutter at the side. So I've covered these 17 different authors, and I hope it's a book that will appeal to everybody that loves books and loves cats. But even if you don't have a particular fondness for felines, there are still people who are not cat lovers who are loving the book, saying that it's taught them a lot about quirky stories about writers and the whole process of creation, about the joy of owning a pet and also its responsibilities, and the lessons to be learned from sharing one's home with an animal. If this book does well and loads of people buy copies, the next book is going to be Great Writers and the Dogs Who Loved Them. And that way I'll keep all the dog people happy as well as the cat people. So I'm grateful to all the cats in my life who have given me joy, and I hope that cats and authors will continue to cohabit in truly wonderful ways. And there we can see a cat looking awfully cute with a book. But I was very, very fortunate that my book was accepted by the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Honestly, if I'd searched the world for a publisher, I couldn't have done better than the Bodleian. They've been a total joy to work with. They've produced a very beautiful book. It's got lovely little paw prints on the inside papers. And, there's a nice bookmark. I love the cover of it. It's a really quality book. They've done a lovely job for me. And they have been absolutely gorgeous to work with. And there are cats that roam the Bodleian today to keep those mice away. So I mentioned the Bodleian cats in my book as well. But it really was an absolute privilege to be published by the Bodleian Library in Oxford. So that's my book. If you don't get my free newsletter, Notes from a Book Addict, sign up for it using the code or just pick up one of the little leaflets on the table. I've also got leaflets for my literary tours that are coming up over the next couple of years, so all sorts of lovely travels that might tempt you. I have some information for the Jane Austen Society of Australia. I hope everyone in this room knows that it's Jane Austen's 250th birthday in 2 months' time, and the whole world is celebrating this major event. Sadly, I couldn't put Jane Austen into my book. She made one reference to a kitten, and we don't even know its name. And even I, Jane Austen addict as I am, could not make a chapter out of one nameless kitten. So do subscribe to the newsletter, pick up the leaflets, and of course I'm very happy to sign books for anyone who would like one. So does anybody have questions they would like to ask? Yes.
Yes, what about the sexing in the 1780s? Did they do that? Or just...
Unless the equipment got infected, then no. And so of course drowning kittens was a very common thing. You know, your cat would just produce a litter of kittens you didn't want anymore on your farm or your property, and cats would simply be drowned, which is horrible. We hate to think of that happening. But no, de-sexing, it was a very long time before that happened. So, just lots and lots of cats. And they led, on the whole, a very tough life. I mean, during the Middle Ages, cats were seen as the familiar of witches or the devil. And, you know, for children to throw stones at a cat was considered perfectly acceptable behaviour. So, or they were tied onto the tails of bears that were being used in bear baiting to madden the bear. So, you know, they did terrible things, just awful. But, you know, fortunately, we've become more humane in some ways, and cats are much better treated today. But it was a bit gruesome reading of some of the things that happened. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of someone who had 23 cats in their house.
Yes.
Not D6.
No, there's going to be a lot more cats.
I know.
And the Hemingway house evidently was very pongy because of all the cats. And that one of the wives said they've all got to go into the tower. And the tower was so pongy, I think you could hardly enter it. But Hemingway knew the names of all his cats. And he knew pretty much their ages, their personalities, and they'd be buried nicely in the cemetery when they went to cat heaven. And so he knew them all. But yes, there must have been a smell. Any other questions? Yes.
About the cat who accompanied you?
Well, he's not mine, although I'm quite tempted to take him home. He's so beautiful. But one of the staff brought him. His name, I believe, is Miffy. And he's, as far as I can tell, being very well behaved around the corner. But so he should be. He's heard nothing but praise about his species from the whole talk. So he should be a very happy cat. I have had many cats in my life, and I do currently only have one, but only sort of. A lady who lives along the road began to feed my cat. I asked her not to. She said, "I'm Greek, I can't help it." And so Pearl is being fed, I think, on caviar down the road and turns her nose up when she comes to our place and gets cat bickies offered. So we're not actually seeing all that much of her. So I'm thinking maybe next year it is time for a kitten again, because I do love cats. So, and my lovely cat Topaz sadly died as I was writing the book, so I missed her beautiful waving tail and her gorgeousness and her softness. So it is so sad when one loses a beloved cat. Any other questions? Anyone? But yes.
What do you think about the legislation?
Yes, it's controversial. And with a cat that wanders, I mean, my cats have only ever killed rats and mice, which I'm okay about, but I don't live in a bush area where they could easily get at birds, and they've never killed a bird. But yes, I mean, they are causing a huge amount of damage to native birds. So really, in many ways, an indoor cat, unless you're very inner city and, you know, it's not going to roam. And some of them are roamers. See, I had two cats that were siblings, and one became known as the Tart of Paddington because she slept on so many different beds that weren't hers. And the other one, her sister, stayed at home and was as good as gold. So it's just something in the cat that means it wants to wander. But, yeah, sadly, I think, you know, legislation might be needed, yeah. So I didn't mind them killing cockroaches either. That was fine. Any other questions? Well, thank... Oh, sorry, Tony. Absolutely. He wrote biography, history. He wrote biography of his ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough. He wrote books about the war, books about the Boer War in South Africa. He had a massive number of books and won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So very... For those books, not nothing... No, it was nothing to do with being Prime Minister. So it wasn't the Nobel Peace Prize or anything like that. It was, and of course he was a wartime prime minister. But yes, he won the Nobel Prize for literature. So he was a very fine writer and, of course, wrote those incredible speeches that he gave during the war, which were so, you know, suitable for the times. Yeah. Okay, I think that's probably all with questions. So thank you so much for coming along today, and I hope you enjoy the book. Thank you. Which I do have to mention, had a blissfully fabulous review in the Sydney Morning Herald on Saturday. I don't know if you heard my shrieks of delight coming from Paddington, but gosh, I was a happy woman all day. It was just the most perfect book review. I couldn't have asked for a word to be changed, so that was really exciting. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.